Protests in St. Louis over the acquittal of a former police officer in the shooting death of Anthony Lamar Smith might feel from afar like deja vu all over again. But there is at least one big difference between the current protests and what we saw in Ferguson in 2014. And that is, the country on the whole doesn't seem as invested in what's going on. Even here in Kansas City, we aren't talking much about chaos and turmoil on the other side of the state. Pepper spray, mass arrests, shut down traffic, and police trading chants with protesters about who owns the streets. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And today we're going to check in on our neighbors to the east. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a question about racial tensions in St. Louis. Our guests will do their best to paint a clear picture for you. Let's start with a reporter from St. Louis Public Radio, Willis Ryder Arnold. Good morning.
Good morning.
So just for a recap, can you bring our listeners up to speed on the basic timeline of what's been going on in St. Louis?
Sure. Basically, for the last 5 weeks, there have been protests that came out after the Jason Stockley trial over the shooting death of Anthony Lamar Smith. The shooting occurred in 2011, but the verdict for the trial didn't come down until this fall.
So what are some of the sort of, I don't know, like, what was your first sense that this was going to turn into something?
Well, protesters or community activists and organizers had kind of let people know that they could expect actions. There was a call for 100 days of actions, possibly more, by area activists and organizers. So people
before
kind of
the verdict even came down.
Exactly. Thank you for that clarification, which kind of set us up to know that things were going to be happening. But the morning that the verdict was actually announced, protests started immediately outside the courthouse, and they've kind of continued on and off over the last 5 weeks.
Some of, just from my own, like, reading of news and watching of online videos, one of the things that has really just kind of sent chills down my spine is this story I read in The Guardian about police chanting "whose streets are streets" at protesters while arresting people.
Yes. So that was a very, that night could only be described as a flashpoint. It was Sunday, September 17th. More than 120 arrests were made that night after protesters had moved from being in front of the police station to downtown St. Louis. During that time, a couple windows were broken and police came out kind of in force. They sequestered different groups and kind of broke up the protest. That then moved into some remaining protesters who were downtown, and other people that were just in the area were kettled, which is an action where police don't allow protesters or people in an area to leave before making arrests. And then there was basically a mass arrest, and some people were pepper sprayed. And afterwards, the police used a protest chant, which is very common here, "whose streets are streets?" And they kind of made that their own in that instance.
There was a pretty strong response to that from organizations of police officers. I mean, not just from protesters and civilians.
Yeah, it was kind of condemned as this usurping of language that was being used by a different side. And people took it to be a very aggressive engagement with what was going on and somewhat disrespectful for people that were out trying to express their First Amendment rights.
It seems like one of the big differences between what's going on right now and what happened in 2014 is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like protests now are centered around wealthier areas or business districts, places like outside the police academy, like targeted at the seat of power, as opposed to erupting in communities that could be described as like downtrodden themselves.
I'd say that's absolutely accurate. We saw a lot of protests after the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson that were focused on Ferguson, that were focused on the area in which he was shot and a major intersection nearby. Those protests kind of would start during the day and then continue through the night, depending on how police and protesters responded to each other. Here, we've seen a couple different tactic changes. There's been a focus on primarily appearing in white neighborhoods and business districts. There's been a strong attention to protesters kind of policing their own, making sure that people are communicating, making sure that people that are feeling more vitriolic are being addressed by other protesters and kind of talked down. And there's been a kind of move that is protesters have an official end. People that are organizing specific actions, like at the Galleria or like at outside the police headquarters or downtown, they'll kind of have an action, plan a march, plan another way of vocalizing their opinions, and then say, like, this is over now. We have come to make our voices known. And those of us that, like, agreed to participate in this action are, like, wrapping up. However, some people stick around afterwards. But that is a kind of distinction that is certainly different than what we were seeing in 2014, 2015.
Is there a difference in how police are handling it from their side?
Somewhat. I think that there are some ways that the police have also learned different tactics. At different times, it seems like they've had a had less patience, really. They've decided, like, this action happened, and now we're done. I think a good one to point to is there's a highway protest where protesters blocked traffic. That's something that wasn't that uncommon, actually, in 2014 over time. But that happened once here, and police allowed protesters to come off the street and then just immediately arrested everybody involved. I spoke with protesters who were out that night who had asked police whether or not they were going to be arrested, if there was anything, if they were going to be instructed to leave or disperse. And the response they say they received from police was just, you're going to be arrested.
You know, I mentioned a chant, the police chanting whose streets are streets earlier. There's another chant that kind of caught my attention, and that is a chant on the part of the protesters, which is, if you kill our kids, we will kill your economy. Can you talk to me about, I mean, does that summarize the where people are coming from in these protests?
Absolutely. There has been a strong focus, and I should have said this earlier when I was talking about a kind of tactical change on behalf of protesters, that there is a strong attention to economic influence. Various protesters have said that they think there has been an impact of at least $10 million. And in that includes over $4 million of police overtime, which the city has to spend to keep police employed at the moment. And they're saying that that's going to have an effect, the protesters. We have another reporter at the station who spoke with an economist who said that $10 million is a drop in the bucket in the state's economy. That's not going to have that much of an effect. I spoke then with another protester who said, okay, well, talk to us in a year, and we'll see whether or not that the growing amount of economic disruption is still is having an effect and grabbing people's attention.
You have significant experience covering protests. This goes back to the Occupy Wall Street movement, and I'm curious about what you see as the direction protest is taking in general.
I think there's been a kind of habit that's developed where protesters understand a rhythm of how a protest is going to go. I believe that police are kind of experiencing the same thing. There's a lot of attention to kind of geography during protests. There's a lot of common overlap between stuff that happened at Occupy and what's happening now in terms of communication. We're seeing things like mic checks where organizers are using a mic check where they say, you know, mic check, and then people are intended to respond in order to indicate that there is going to be an announcement or a piece of information distributed among protests. So that's something that was...
It's almost like professional.
I think that there's certainly a kind of professionalization of it. I don't think that anyone's, like, seeing this as their own occupation, but there are
people
that
I don't mean professional in the financial sense. I just mean in the level of sort of, I don't know, sophistication and strategizing.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely correct, that people have a very specific set of goals that they're thinking about when they go out and have protests. It's not just people sitting down and saying, you know, we're not going anywhere, we're upset. It's people saying, we're here, we're going to several different places, we're upset, and here are goals for how this action should play out. Sometimes I think that's intentional arrest. Sometimes I think that's making sure that the action happens without any arrest.
You know, what do you think about, I mean, how much is this a part of daily life in St. Louis right now? Is there an element of business as usual, or is this really a significant disruption?
That's kind of a complicated question because it really depends on where you live. Again, you know, if you live in the county outside of the city proper, I think that your daily life is probably not that affected in a practical sense. If you're in the city, I think it's very common that you're going to end up like running into a protest at some point. You know, we've seen things at malls, we've seen things in business districts, we've seen things in downtown. But if you're kind of commuting or a highway user, you can pass by a lot of that stuff. It really depends on where your life is situated. However, I can say that the conversation is happening regularly and among, I'd say, most people.
I want to stick with you for, you know, a little bit. We're going to come back to you, but I want to hear now from Rasheen Aldridge. He's a longtime community activist and a Fifth Ward committee man. Rasheen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How would you describe what's going on in St. Louis right now?
Right now in St. Louis, I think you have the same thing that kind of came out of Ferguson. You have a community and a group of people that still feel that justice continues not to come to either their neighborhood or to individuals that look like them. And we're fed up. You know, we're tired. We've been here. 2014, when Mike Brown was killed, you think that we would have learned some lessons. And when I mean we, I mean the individuals and powers to be, the ones who have the power to make the change that we, the protesters and our communities, have been asking for decades. But people are fed up. But I think now we're more organized. We're more aware of our surroundings. You know, we didn't kind of been through this, so we're ready to do this for a long haul. But people are tired. People are tired and want justice at the end of the day.
Tell me more about yourself and your background in the city.
So I was born and raised here in St. Louis. I actually love my city. I was one of the children that went to the county school but lived in the city. So at an early age, I had like these special lenses on because even though I lived in the city, I commuted out to West County, which was 30 minutes away. Very rich county. You know, when you walk outside, the air is much nicer, the grass seems greener, just a lot more opportunities and things that can be done. But
when you said you commuted there, can you explain a little more what you mean by that?
I took a bus every morning, so from kindergarten all the way to 12th grade. And the times vary because, you know, as from elementary to middle school and high school, times change when school starts. But from kindergarten all the way to 12th grade, I would get up super early around 5 a.m. To take a bus out to my school.
I mean, were you part of desegregation? Was that it?
Yeah, it was a deseg program, which now I think they're slowly phasing out. But I was part of the deseg program, and which, I mean, I appreciate it. I got that diversity at an early age. But and like I said, kind of gave me these special lenses of, you know, why one part of a neighborhood or one part of a community was nice. But when I would come home to my community, I would feel almost like an animal in cage. So it was a plus and a minus, I guess, for those 13 years.
Can you tell me more about the feeling like an animal in the cage?
I mean, it's just, you know, coming back to my own community and not being able to have those same opportunities and things. Like I say, when I would go out to the county school, after school was over and I would go to my Caucasian friend's home or Jewish friend's home, you know, we would leave the school and walk to their home, and it would just be, you know, just walking to the gas station and hanging out with your fellow like peers that you've seen at school and not getting messed with. Unlike my community, where I would go back home and there wasn't a playground, there wasn't a gas station, there wasn't like a place where you would see your friends at school. We had to make our own fun with rocks or whatever, you know, little small things that kids would do and later get harassed by like law enforcement or police officers as we would walk up the street. So it never really seemed fair in the place that I call home. It was vacant. There was nothing. There was no opportunities. There was no playground. And this place that wasn't my community that I went to go get an education just seemed, I always wanted to be out there. I didn't want to kind of go home because there was so much out there. There was so much things to do. There was so much more opportunity. And I just didn't understand in my own community where I laid my head on a day-to-day basis why those things didn't exist. And as I got older, I guess I put those thoughts into action.
Yeah, I mean, were you involved in Ferguson?
Yep. So I was involved in Ferguson. Right before Ferguson, I was actually part of the Fight for 15 here in St. Louis, which is called Show Me 15, for several years. And my store was the first
to raise the minimum wage.
To raise the minimum wage for $15 an hour, and also to get unions for workers, because it doesn't make sense that no one should be not making a livable wage and working two or three jobs. But I was part of that movement, and when Ferguson actually happened, it's funny, me, Janina, who's a leader in the movement, and Charmel, who was a leader in the Fight for 15 movement here in St. Louis, we actually went out to Ferguson to try to use the skills we learned in the Fight for 15 movement to help organize and to kind of keep people calm, and not calm like, you know, not yelling and stuff like that, but keep everyone organized so the police wouldn't have anything to try to use to say they're being violent or, you know, this is a protest that is disorderly. But we found ourselves quickly turning from organizers kind of into protesters, being affected by what happened to Mike Brown and hearing how the police were so vicious to the community, and realizing that, you know, Mike Brown honestly could have been one of us or one of our cousins or our sister, our brother. And it really, I think, touched us in a different type of way from the Fight for 15 movement.
You know, during Ferguson in 2014, a lot of people went to Ferguson to join the protests, and a lot of media attention from outside of St. Louis was on what was going on there. Does it feel like people from outside your community are paying attention now?
Definitely. I think, you know, we've been able, you know, Ferguson was the epic center of something, unfortunate, a tragedy, but at the same time, we've been able to really push people to have a conversation, of which, if you ask me, it's a conversation that we should have been having. I mean, there's been statistics, there's been commissions, there's been plenty of reports on the effect of oppression and police brutality and poverty in certain communities and what that does. But after Ferguson and it happening in Ferguson and then Ohio and New York, it's been great to have that conversation to figure out what is the next step to move forward so every community can have justice, so we can have an equitable place to live. But I do think somewhere during Ferguson and now, which I'm happy a little bit that the protest has picked back up, but it's unfortunate again that we're protesting after another death of a black man, that there's enough evidence where there should have been some type of charge. But the conversation seems to be different. The conversation seems to be now really focused and figuring out a strategy plan on what can we do. You know, Ferguson was, it was new to everybody. You know, it was new to the protesters. It was new to police officers. It was new to organizations. The way that everything happened, the way that the people resisted, the way that the police came with militarized force, no one was ready. So I think now we've been able to make moves by getting, you know, individuals like myself in office, folks running organizations. So now when it happened, we're a lot more strategic, and the individuals who are having the conversation have more of a focus and understand it, since we'd have been through it and seeing some of those same things and horrible tactics that the police or law enforcement have been doing, have been able to kind of re-energize that conversation into a different lane and focus to get people to really understand what's going on.
Well, if you out there have a question for our guests about what's going on in St. Louis, you still have a little time to ask it at 816-235-2888. We had a call from Paul in Kansas City, Missouri, who was in the Army, and in 2015, he and some other soldiers, he tells us, were traveling home to Kansas City and stopped for gas in St. Louis. And he said that that an older black man came up to them and was really upset and wanted to know why they were there. And he is just expressing that he feels for people in St. Louis, that the level of tension has reached that point, and has, it sounds to him anyway, like it's kind of stayed there. Can you talk to me about that?
I mean, I think St. Louis is unique in its own way. Missouri is, as you guys being our partners on the other side of Kansas City, I think this state, but St. Louis is unique for having, I think, historically very high, you know, racial tensions, not necessarily due to community within communities, but if you ask me, I think it's the system and things that apply to the system that are making these tensions only greater and dividing, you know, us more when you have just present time, when you have, you know, law enforcement going out saying whose streets are our streets, or the police association, the leader Jeff Reuter saying divisive things and only the dividing protesters and law enforcement, but for folks that are looking at this on the news and stuff, dividing communities among communities, it's just unfortunate, and it's not helping. And I think the ones in power are only making the situation worse, and only dividing communities, only dividing black and white more. And one thing that the movement, Black Lives Movement, have said, and you know, we said here on the ground, is that, you know, this is a movement of everyone. This is a movement of love. This is a movement for all people. You know, we just want justice for people of color. We want equitable policies for people of color. We want to be treated equally. Majority of the people that are in the protest sometimes with us are our white allies, which we don't even call them allies because they're our brothers and sisters in the movement. So I think for years, the ones in power, even former mayor, have only done things to divide our communities and divide agencies and to divide us more. And we know when you're divided, the power to be always win. But when people are united and can have those tough, uncomfortable conversations and get past those tough, uncomfortable conversations that only move us forward, we become a better St. Louis. We become a better community. We become a better country.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in and ask Willis Ryder Arnold of St. Louis Public Radio. I mean, what else can you add about just context and how much this is about St. Louis in particular and how much this is about either Missouri as a state or the country as a whole?
I have to be clear that my kind of understanding of it picks up 3 years ago when I moved here. I'm not from Missouri, so I have a much younger understanding of the issues. However, I agree with Rasheen that I think a lot of the issues are specifically systemic. I think that there are things, habits, and actual practices that have been in place for years without people really paying attention to it. I think that, you know, in 2014, the tragedy that happened really redirected public conversation regarding race in the country and how that factors into contemporary society and some ways that racism at this time is much more insidious in that people think it's not as present as it is. And I think that conversation has evolved. The idea of systemic racism is something that I didn't hear people discuss with regularity 3 years ago, but here I hear it a lot now. And I think that people are really looking for that systemic change for policy and practice to kind of be aligned with the conversations that are actually happening in the city.
What's your sense, Willis, of how, of the amount of attention on St. Louis right now? I mean, in national news, in international news, among the like national protest community, for example?
I think that it's interesting. In 2014, there was a much larger kind of like explosion of media coverage that was happening at the moment. But because that conversation continued into other parts of the country, and we've seen other actions from San Francisco to New York, from Minnesota down to Texas, that conversation has actually become broader and less focused here on St. Louis. I think at this moment, because of what's happening here, there's another kind of redirection of attention back here to St. Louis. A lot of it focused on that kind of moment that you brought up earlier when police chanted whose streets, in that there have been some flashpoints of real conflict and kind of moments where it's exposed that there are those tensions aren't just kind of underneath everything, but are actually coming to a head again.
Rasheen, as someone who not only calls St. Louis home, but I mean, you started out saying that you love your city. On an emotional level, what does this moment mean to you?
When I actually heard the verdict, I work at City Hall, so I work right across the street from the courts. And the youth in me always gives me optimism and hope that maybe this time is going to be something different. And I really did think that this time, with the video evidence, with actually seeing it, with hearing former officer Stockley say, "I'm gonna kill this MF-er," that there was enough evidence to charge him with something. And when I heard that there was no charge, I instantly ran out of the office and kind of burst into tears, and kind of just brought back these memories of Ferguson, of being out there protesting and going back home, and asking myself, what does it really mean to be Black in America? Why I continue to try right at a young age? So it brings back a lot of memories, but it also gives me a lot of hope to see the same individual young people on the ground organizing again, but in a more strategic and a more forward directional way. So it's hopeful, but it's tough.
Thank you so much for sharing that story with us.
No problem.
And Willis Ryder Arnold of St. Louis Public Radio, thank you.
Thank you.
You can keep tweeting us your questions about St. Louis. We're at KCURCST. Up next, the Me Too campaign on social media. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to talk about the post of the week, I would say, on social media. A simple, straightforward Me Too from people who have experienced sexual harassment or assault. And the sheer volume of posts, I'd say, sends a pretty clear message about the prevalence of this stuff in our culture. It feels like a movement of some kind, and people have been wrestling in their own quiet way with whether and how to join in. So have you posted Me Too? And if not, why not? If so, what's that been like? 816-235-2888. I want to start by introducing Michelle Smirnova, a sociologist at UMKC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Would you call this a movement?
You know, I think it's important. I know Alyssa Milano sort of reignited this conversation recently, but the Me Too hashtag precedes even hashtags themselves. A Black woman named Tarana Burke was the original creator of Me Too, and she did see it as a movement, particularly reaching out to survivors from underprivileged communities and women of colors.
I just want to jump in and clarify. I mean, if this preceded social media, this movement is very much this moment in the movement is very social media driven. What form did it take before?
Before, I think it was reaching out to victims of sexual assault, particularly women of color, and helping them recognize that they weren't alone, that this was something that other people were going through as well. Sort of this Me Too, that you shouldn't be ashamed about this experience. You're not to blame for this experience. And there's a lot of other people who are going through it. And so I think with that legacy in mind, it's very much, I think, a movement today in not only solidarity, but also enlightening or creating this awareness that this is happening to women everywhere. And some women I know talked about their hesitancy to post at all, that I didn't feel like a victim, that that's just normal that I was treated in that way. And sort of to legitimize this experience that this is not okay, that this is a part of a broader rape culture, that this harassment is so normalized, and that if to make progress, we need to recognize that this isn't the way we want things to be.
I am interested in that impulse that I think a lot of us have felt to dismiss experiences as normal without maybe even realizing it. Just that asking that question, is anything I experienced, does it go beyond a duh kind of thing? Mm-hmm. Is it worth speaking about? Is it worth sharing? Mm-hmm. Is it worth drawing attention to? Realizing that, like, even personally, that I have those questions about my own life is weird for me, because I like to think of myself as someone who thinks there is no level of acceptability in sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think it's, you can simultaneously have this feeling of, I don't tolerate this sort of behavior, but also simultaneously want to be strong, that I don't want to be a victim. And I think the way that we treat victims of sexual assault and rape is different than we treat victims of robberies or other sorts of crimes, that they often are blamed or asked questions about, well, did you do something to create this situation? And
like, how much money did they take from my wallet?
Exactly. And so I think there's no incentive for women to come forward, because we struggle with reconciling gender and being recognized on an equal playing field in the beginning. And so to come forward with this sort of feeling of being a victim, that it's somehow taking away from our strength and our equality. And I think women are made to feel ashamed of these experiences they've gone through, and that just toughen up, that this is, it's not that big of a deal, brush it off.
What are you observing about sort of like how this is or isn't moving a needle on the conversation? I mean, are you seeing, as a sociologist, something interesting happening regarding just like not just the individual experience, but mm-hmm. some larger phenomenon?
Well, I think we see a lot of this inspired recently by the outing of Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes and Harvey Weinstein. And so in an optimistic tone, you could think that we now are there's this increasing culture of acceptability for women to come forward, that you have support, that this is not okay, and that there might actually be consequences for the first time. But Harvey Weinstein, they made jokes at the Oscars about his assault, and there was an episode on 30 Rock about him, people sleeping with him. So it was something that everybody knew and people were complicit in for so long. And I think similarly that there's been a lot of backlash against Gwyneth Paltrow and other actresses who were victims in this case. Well, why didn't you come forward earlier? And without attention on the men, the other people in power who were complicit and who were equally as aware and had less to lose than the victims who have to relive that horror of going through. So I think it is part of a larger movement of perhaps talking about how this isn't okay.
It's interesting, too, how asking anyone who's experienced anything on the spectrum from like harassment to assault to go through that experience of sharing, mm-hmm. it makes you realize how intimidating that experience really is. That
mm-hmm. absolutely.
That you don't want to do it. Yeah. Well, I'm also sitting here with a local opera singer who I've interviewed before, Victoria Botero. She wrote two posts that were really powerful. So she's going to start off our out loud with our actual voices and not just typing voices, that sharing. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Gina.
So tell me a little bit about your story and your two-part contribution to the Me Too campaign.
Well, I'm not on Facebook that often, and so I had not been on for a few days, and I checked, I guess it was about 2 days ago, and I went online late at night, and I saw this, like, one after another, hashtag Me Too statements, and it took me about less than a second to understand what was going on and why that was happening, and I scrolled through it, and it was this veil of tears and this just litany of shame from really almost every woman I knew, women of color, really powerful women, women in Europe, women in South America. I have a really nice, wonderfully, you know, diverse group of women on my Facebook page. I read through that, and then I, you know, had planned on just checking for a few minutes, and I turned it off, and I went back to work. But it just bothered me, and I thought, am I going to write a post? Because of course, Me Too. Of course, Me Too.
When you say of course, Me Too, I totally get what you're saying, but there could be listeners who don't know what you're saying.
Of course, I've experienced sexual harassment in many ways. Of course, and I I mean, the stories that, you know, just starting from childhood, that of instances where this happened. I thought of the first moment that I can remember. I was on a bus with my grandmother, and the bus was packed full of people. I was maybe 10 years old, and this man came up against me. He was standing. I was sitting. This man came up against me, and he started rubbing himself against my shoulder. And my 10-year-old self was very – I was like, oh, he's just, you know – wants to take my seat. And it didn't stop. And then I started to realize something else is going on. And my grandmother, who's sitting next to me, I looked at her and kind of like, what's happening? And she switched seats with me. And she turned to me and she said, that man's really bothersome. And my grandmother then was the object of this man's harassment and abuse. And I thought about that. At that point, my grandmother had incredible courage to protect me, but she also didn't feel empowered to tell that man to stop or to tell other people on the bus that this man was hurting me. And then her. So I thought, me too. Of course, this has happened since I was young and has happened before. So I wrote a post about this still continues to happen because we're not speaking up. Not just that women feel this fear, but also that the men around us don't feel apparently empowered or that they can also speak up when they see women in their lives are being affected.
We're going to hear more about Victoria's two-part post in the Me Too campaign and your decision to post or not and how that's affected you. Call 816-235-2888 with your story. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to continue our conversation with sociologist Michelle Smirnova and singer Victoria Botero about the Me Too campaign. And Victoria, you were talking just before break about the kind of thinking you were doing before you posted. Are you able to share with us? I know this is such a hard story, but what it is you did post and why two parts?
Well, I did it in two parts for a few reasons. First, when I thought about posting, I realized, I've actually written this post before. It was exactly a year ago. Exactly a year ago, by a few days, the Access Hollywood tape had just come out where our, you know, then candidate Trump and now President Trump bragged about sexually assaulting women. And I remember that after that happened, many women posted on Facebook about their own experiences and their anger. And at that point, I chose not to post. And I thought, well, here we are again. And it's Harvey Weinstein, you know, has sort of created this impetus to post again. And I thought, what am I going to do? What does this add to the conversation if I post what's happened to me? Why does this keep happening? And so I posted first, about accountability, and it's about accountability from men, asking, basically stating that this is a culture of misogyny that we live in. And it's not that every man is a perpetrator. Not every man is Donald Trump or Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby. But every man, just like every woman, me too, every man knows an instance that where a woman has been made to feel uncomfortable, denigrated, has been made to feel powerless. So I wrote first a post about accountability of what it looks like of why men need to stand up, to be upstanders, to support women who are being abused, and not to be bystanders.
And then you shared something else.
And then I shared a second post about what it looks like to be an upstander. I shared an experience, a relationship that I had been in, and to be fair, I was not. It was not a relationship of sexual abuse, but it was an abusive relationship, and it was ongoing for several years. And it was very confusing, and I didn't understand what was going on. And I detailed the men in my life who stood up for me and helped me in many ways by listening, by driving me somewhere when I needed help, by getting someone who could help me help myself. That's what it looks like to stand up for a woman.
By telling the stories of these men who
were generous and courageous and present. It is through that that you really did tell your own story. And right. I wonder also, it seems like such a different approach to make the active party in the story the men, whether not just men who are perpetrating, but men who are standing up and helping.
Right. I want to see this movement do something more. I'm so grateful that the women in my life, all the women who've used this hashtag, are able to empathize and really own up to what's happened to them. But I need to see change in my life, and I need to see it today. And so I wrote that post about accountability for the men to stand up for women. If you're in a business meeting and there's a woman in your office who is trying to speak and she's spoken over, then say, oh, you know what? Mary's trying to say something. Let's let her finish her conversation. It's a culture where that we need to stop right from the beginning, where women are empowered to speak up. And it takes other people around them, particularly men, to see when a woman is not empowered, to help them speak.
Let's talk to Annie in Leawood. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Gina.
What's your story?
Well, I wanted to just mention how I had been seeing everyone on my own Facebook feed posting their Me Toos, including several men I know, and including myself. I posted mine. And the following morning, I was at a gas station in South Kansas City, just filling up gas on my way to work, and a man had come out and from the service station, and from behind me, I heard him say, you know, just, hey, cutie, and you're looking fine, and, you know, just that whole business, and handed me his business card. And it was so run-of-the-mill, so everyday, that normally I wouldn't even think of mentioning it to anyone, because it just happens all the time. But I thought, you know, everyone is doing the Me Too thing and the Harvey Weinstein thing, and maybe I should post about it on Facebook. And I did, including how, when I was thinking about what I would say, that I would change my response. And I realized that I was ashamed of how I handled it. I just, you know, I kept my head down. You know, the automatic instinctual responses kick in. You turn away, you pretend you can't hear them. You know, make sure there's nothing about your body language that indicates that you're interested, and it's so automatic. And I just said, okay, thanks. And I took his business card and waited for him to go away. And of course he honked and whistled on his way out of the gas station too. But I realized that my own shame about not having called him out on the spot or something was keeping me from talking about it. And I said, I'm going to talk about it anyway. And I'm going to say how I actually handled it. Because when you're there in that moment, all you can think about is your own safety. You know, all you can hear are the alarm bells going off. And, you know, you don't really have your, it's 2017, it's not okay to talk to people that way, speech ready to go when they catch you off guard like that.
Well, but and you just want the experience
really
to end, too.
I'm sorry?
You just want the experience to be over, too, to cut it off.
Right, right. Just engage as little as possible and get it over with so I can get about my day. And I was really overwhelmed by the response from my friends and how many people could relate to that exact situation where, you know, in that moment, you just do what you need to do. It's instinctual.
Was it strange to you to realize that you had so many friends who had the same experience and that you guys hadn't just talked about that before?
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. Like, with your girlfriends, you talk about how, you know, these things happen all the time, but you don't really talk about what do you do in that moment. And you always assume it's not enough, it's not good enough. And that if you tell people that you just said, okay, thanks, and, you know, didn't call them out, that you're going to get shamed somehow for perpetuating the problem, for making it worse, for not, you know, standing up.
For not defending the sisterhood.
But then I realized that I've been conditioned to keep my mouth shut about it, you know. Women have been trained to just take it, to tell yourself it's not a big deal and keep your mouth shut.
Annie,
and that makes me very angry.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call. I am curious, Victoria, did you feel, I mean, you had been sitting on this post for a year before this campaign even started. Did you feel like you needed this, you needed a reason to share this story? You needed something to be going on. You know what I mean? Like, this experience had been your experience for a long time. Mm-hmm. Is having this sort of large-scale invitation to share a story, is that important? Does it do something that inspires people?
I felt like, you know, in this past year, I've done a lot of work working through what had happened to me. And I am tired of being ashamed. And I was tired of holding that story in. And what happened to me was not my fault. And I will do anything if I can help another woman avoid what happened to me. And I would do anything if I could help a man help a woman who is in this situation. And that's why I finally wrote it down. And that's what I saw over and over again, was the fear of sharing these stories. I was afraid to come on the show today, worried about what are the repercussions for me personally, professionally, for my child. But the risk of staying silent is far greater.
Michelle Smirnova, I mean, you've been speaking to us as a sociologist, but is this personal for you too?
I think it's personal for all women. I think the dough that you said, like, why I didn't feel like posting, because it's obvious. And I know a lot of people said anyone who's been a victim of harassment or sexual assault. And I think it's important to identify non-binary, gender non-conforming, that men are also victims. But to not name women is to treat this the same way to treat it as a colorblind issue, that it would be great that one day gender did not matter. But right now it has really huge consequences. And yes, it was personal for me. And it's difficult for me similarly to identify myself as a victim and for identify those times when I didn't speak up on my behalf, because I do that for a living. And then in my personal life, I similarly brush it under that we treat benevolent sexism as though it's not the same as hostile sexism, but these are related, that it's a precursor, this entitlement to women's attention. And I think the fact that people are coming forward and that we're starting to have a conversation is a really powerful, optimistically turning point where it's not okay, and that there will be actual consequences for people, the perpetrators, legal consequences, financial consequences, but also shame enough to destroy someone's career, which I don't think has been the case for most of our history.
What about change in communities? I mean, I read a post from a local woman who runs a restaurant, and she said that she's 50, that she posted Me Too, just those words, and that younger women in the time since then who work for her have felt safe coming to her for help. And I'm curious, Victoria, as someone who's posted, do you feel like there's already a change in how you are relating to your community, your role in your community?
Well, I received a lot of responses, all positive, thanking me for my courage in sharing my story. And I am grateful for that. You know, it's interesting, as I was writing it, I didn't feel the fear that I felt a year ago. So that's a change for me. So that's good. And I hope that other women maybe are encouraged. But I posted about accountability for men. And I asked very specifically, not rhetorical questions, what are you doing to help women? What are you doing to create parity today, tomorrow? Did you include women on your team, in your C-suite, on your board? And did you include more than one? And no one answered me. Not a single man in my Facebook community answered me. And I reposted it. No, that's not a rhetorical question. I want answers.
Wow. You are coming to this with a lot of clarity, and I wish you luck as you pursue those answers, Victoria.
Thank you.
Victoria Botero, thank you so much for sharing such an intimate story and such an important one. and Michelle Smirnova here with us from UMKC's Sociology Department. Thank you for being here, too.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this morning's discussions at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the hour, we heard about ongoing protests in St. Louis and tensions there between the community and the police. If you feel like you need to get caught up on that story on the other side of the state, please check that conversation out. And tomorrow, we will be having a portrait session with a local violinist who used to play on a World Cup soccer team for Western Samoa. That story tomorrow at 10. And you can keep talking to us about the Me Too campaign or about protests in our culture today. We're at KCURCST on Twitter, so talk to us anytime. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. With help from intern Tom Taylor, I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.